She was gonna keep. Oh yeah, alright. Take it easy, baby. Make it last all night. She was an American girl.
This is Deborah Craddock, a podcast where we sit down with everyday Americans and hear their extraordinary stories. I'm your host, Deborah Drucker. Come along with me as we discuss those things that we were always told not to talk about: politics, religion, and more. I promise you'll be inspired and have your mind opened by the end of this episode.
Well, it was kind of cold that night. She stood alone on the balcony. Yeah, she could hear the cars roll by out on 441, like waves crashing on the beach.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Deborah Craddock. Today on Deborah Craddock, we are going to hear the story of Tiana Hamilton. Tiana is a civil engineer who has worked on freeways and other transportation projects all over Southern California. She's an avid tennis player and skier who also likes to spend time in the ocean. Tiana is a volunteer who helps those in need, and she loves to explore the world through travel. She's a mother, a wife, and a good friend to those fortunate enough to know her. Let's hear how this smart and fearless woman became the person she is today. Hello, Tiana. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great. I'm a little bit nervous to be here, but very honored. So thank you for having me.
Well, we hope to put your nerves at ease because you are awesome and we want to get to know your story. So I'm going to get to the beginning. I know you live in Laguna Beach now, but where are you originally from?
Oh, it's a long story. I was born in what was then Yugoslavia, in Belgrade, Serbia, and I lived there until I was about 9, but I grew up in Africa and then moved to Utah in the States and then Laguna Beach. So interestingly enough, this is the place I've lived longest, so it's home.
Who did you grow up with in Yugoslavia?
I grew up with my family, my mom, my dad, my sister, and relatives who were in Belgrade as well.
Okay, so just two daughters.
Just two daughters.
Nice.
4 years apart.
And what was that home life like?
Well, you know, it was interesting, and I was thinking about it today. So I didn't have a typical life even in Serbia. It was communist Yugoslavia at the time. My father was a mining engineer, and we actually had two homes. We had an apartment in what's called New Belgrade now, Novi Belgrade, and that was kind of a Soviet-style high-rise building. But we also lived in Bosnia because my father managed a copper mine in Bosnia. And we had a house there. And I do remember, my vivid memories are of a cow that lived behind our house and the springtime flowers in the cow. And then in the winter, there was snow in the cow.
How beautiful. So, and you're there until what age?
I was there until I was 9.
Until you were 9. So you have a kind of a good recollection of
I do.
Living there.
I have a young recollection. I remember going to school. And my dad's best friend, his colleague, went to work for a company in Zambia in Africa on the copper belt. And he said, "Alex, come and join us." And so it was kind of a good opportunity for us to get out of communist Yugoslavia and go to Africa.
So I know that you learned your English in elementary school in Zambia.
I did. I had taken English classes in Yugoslavia. We all did. My dad spoke like 9 languages. My mom spoke 7, and that's just what you do. And she had taken me to English lessons, but you don't really learn a new language unless you have to speak it all the time with people who don't speak your native tongue.
Okay, so you really refined your English when you got to elementary school in Zambia.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a happy time living in Zambia at this point?
Well, for me, it was lovely. I loved living there. We were in 2 mining towns. I did go to a convent, so the nuns were a little strict, but we traveled quite a bit. We went on a lot of safari. One of the things when you're on a contract like that with those mining companies, you have a lot of vacation and they actually pay for you to go back to wherever you came from on a yearly basis. And my parents were more interested in going to other places. So we went to South America, we went to Asia, we traveled extensively as a family.
So a mining town, when you say that, is a mining town a glamorous town, or is this more of a blue-collar town, or what is that like?
Well, it depends who you are. If you are the management, it's pretty glamorous. It's like living on a country club estate. If you're, you know, in the mines working, it's not quite so glamorous. And Africa is very interesting because a lot of towns in Zambia and Botswana were mining towns. We got there, I think, in 1970, I'm going to say. And the British were still investing a lot in the mines. It hadn't all become nationalized as it is more today.
Okay. And what specifically were they mining for?
So my dad was a specialist in copper, zinc, and gold. So in Zambia and Botswana, it was copper and zinc. And in South Africa, it was gold.
So was it a joyous childhood for you with all the travel and different places and different cultures?
I would say yes, but I was a very shy child. So, it was fun. I went to boarding school also when I turned 12, and that was very difficult because it wasn't culturally what we do. In the Yugoslav Serbian culture, you basically live with your parents until you get married. And yet the British kids who I was hanging out with got sent away to boarding school when they were like 5 or 6. And so that was tough for both my parents and me, as well as my sister, who was 4 years younger. And so as they moved, we actually never really kind of grew up together, except during the summers.
So why did you have to go to boarding school?
Well, once you get past elementary school, there really isn't any sort of good higher education in these developing countries. And so the choices, you either go to Switzerland or to England or South Africa, Rhodesia at the time, but that wasn't a choice for us. So we didn't want to go there.
All right. And when you are a family unit, the four of you hanging around the, you know, the dinner table, are you a family that's discussing politics, being that there's so much political stuff going on at that time?
You know, not really. I was very young when we left Yugoslavia, and I remember stories of it afterwards. But when we were in Yugoslavia, you really didn't talk politics, you know, except with your closest friends. I mean, that just wasn't done. But I learned a lot of things after we left. For example, so the universities in Yugoslavia and probably all over Europe are very specialized. You know, if you want to be a lawyer, you go to law school. If you want to be a doctor, you go to medical school. And my father could only go to the mining school because his father would not become part of the Communist Party. He did not have a party card, but he had connections in the mining industry. So my dad became a mining engineer just like his father for that reason. And so we really didn't talk about it, but we did know that we wanted to leave Yugoslavia. So that was one aspect of it. And then we moved to Zambia, and that had a totally different, it was just newly independent nation. But the interesting thing about a lot of African countries is they're made up of areas that are ruled by very different tribes. And what happened in Zambia in particular was that the biggest tribe basically became the majority tribe. And I think Kenneth Kaunda was president for, you know, 30 years. So it's kind of like a different dictatorship movement. You know, you go from communism, you go to democracy, but it's a very different democracy. And then in South Africa, we had apartheid. So we talked about that a lot. So, you know, we knew we were coming to the United States for
a lot of
those reasons.
A lot of perspective.
Yeah.
And was your father, did he have multiple?
No, we had the Yugoslav citizenship until we moved to the States. We came here on a green card. He was sponsored by the company, which is why we ended up in Utah, because Utah has the largest open pit copper mine in the world. So he was recruited there and we got a green card, and then we went through the naturalization process.
And so when your family did arrive to America, did they then align with any political party? And if so, what was it?
We never really chatted about it. My dad was very liberal, but I would think he probably voted Republican. I really don't know. Have no clue. Never asked him. My mom did not vote. I don't think she ever voted. And I don't know if it was just she never felt like she was home or what. Maybe she just wasn't a political creature.
And so were your parents married until your father passed?
Yes.
Okay.
My dad passed, though, 24 years ago.
Okay. So it sounds like you guys were a pretty tight-knit family.
We were.
Did you have religion in the house?
I am baptized Eastern Orthodox. I would say, are more spiritual than religious. We do have traditions. We celebrate 2 Christmases, 2 New Years as a family, and even today, 2 Easters. We have a saint day. But it's more about family and togetherness, community, than religion.
Okay. And so how did you arrive then at your political perspective?
I vote for the person, not the party. I've seen so many different political organizations that I have a little bit of skepticism about government. What I want to believe is that the government is taking care of the people. And I'm sure you've seen this over the last couple of years. It seems like it's more about continuity and keeping same people in office forever. So I'm not registered as a Republican or a Democrat. Whatever that's called, no political preference.
Nonpartisan.
It used to be independent. And so I've voted both ways. And I think that we are at a difficult point right now. And I say this probably every year. And I think we need a third party. I feel like we need to have more moderate candidates, either side. That's what I'd like. The one thing I would not do is vote for anyone who doesn't support a woman's right to choose. So
thank you. Yeah. I was going to get to that. And I know, Tihana, and what I see is that you've been married for how many years?
35 years.
35 years. That's congratulations.
Fun. Thank you.
You've got 2 wonderful kids, highly productive kids.
Yes.
In fact, your daughter is also a civil engineer, correct?
Yes, structural engineer.
Oh, structural. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a lot of engineers going on in this family. Thank you. We need you. And I know that you are very involved in your community and in so many aspects of the community. And I want to get back to your upbringing. So you moved to Africa. You do elementary school and you learn your English. And then you go, I see, away to this boarding high school in South Africa, Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And tell us about high school in Johannesburg. Give us a visual on that.
The high school was incredibly beautiful, still is. It's an old Dutch estate. It's on the bottom of a foothill, big green grounds, just very beautiful. There's a junior school at the top and then the high school at the bottom and pools and all that kind of stuff. A very British kind of place.
Strict?
It's very strict. It was a British school. So for me, I had to learn another language. So South Africa was bilingual, Afrikaans and English, and you had to pass what's called a Talbond, which means a language exam at the end of your 12 years, but I was only there for 5. So I had to catch up on Afrikaans and learn that and pass that exam. It was an all girls school. It was Episcopalian, like I said, or Church of England, as we called it then. So we had chapel 5 days a week and then church on Saturdays and Sundays. You also had to go to chapel before you could go out and you know, do your thing. And interestingly enough, it was very, very hard when I got there because I wasn't used to that. My family culture was just totally different than this very austere British way of, like, the kids were so disconnected from their parents. But it was actually the best thing that happened to me because I came into my own. I wasn't quite as shy. And
I was going to say, it would create a very independent person.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to stand up on your own all by yourself there.
To the point that when my parents moved to Johannesburg and they lived maybe on the hilltop, maybe 10 minutes away, I stayed a boarder and went home on the weekends. And then they actually moved to the state 6 months before I did. So I stayed in South Africa to matriculate. Oh. Yeah. And I lived with my girlfriend, my best friend still. We were the first girls' boarding school that had a headmaster. And that was her uncle. And he was so strict. The education system was very, very good, and I was good at math and stuff. And I do remember the one thing that kind of really pissed me off. They were saying, well, what do you want to do after you graduate? And I said, well, I want to go be an architect. And he said to me, women can't be architects. Huh. This was in the 70s in South Africa.
Wow.
There's still these stereotypes. They encourage a lot of higher learning, but the learning is for women to become teachers or librarians.
So they have a plan.
They have a plan. So it was very interesting.
That's interesting. And you broke the rules, because what I saw later, and we're going to get to how you go to Utah to go to university.
Mm-hmm.
So out of this boarding school, you've applied and you've decided that you're going to go to Utah?
No, actually. So my parents were already in Utah. I get to Utah. I had no clue that you could apply and go to other universities. That wasn't even a concept that I thought of. So I thought, well, there's a university here. This is where I'm going to go. So I went early. I was 17.
Wow. And what I was going to say there is how you bucked the system. You were one of only two women in your class in the engineering program in this school.
Uh-huh.
And is that still an industry that is predominantly male?
It still is predominantly male, but there are more and more women. My daughter's an example. But it is still, I'm going to say, maybe 10 to 20% female in the specific field of probably civil, mechanical, mining engineering. I think in software engineering, much higher percentage of women, maybe even electrical engineering. I'm not sure of the numbers.
And what compelled you to go into that particular field of study?
Well, I was going to be an architect.
Oh, yes. You were, but you were discouraged.
So the University of Utah did not have an undergrad architecture program. It had a master's. So I was in the civil engineering because I thought, well, it's all the same classes to start off with. So I'll just do civil engineering, do all my basics, and then go into the design portion of it. So I got my degree. I started architecture school. But you know what happened was I went to a design class and they said, well, draw some lines. And I was so excited because this is the first time in my life, you know, engineering is all math and everything's square. I drew all these lines and lines and lines. I was so happy with my lines. And the teacher said, well, these aren't right. And I said, well, how could they not be right? I just said, draw some lines. Anyway, it was a bit of a struggle because I had done a lot of the basics already, the architecture program required. And so it wasn't as exciting for me. And what I was really interested in was doing residential. Like I would draw that all the time. So getting a degree in architecture for multi-level buildings or anything else wasn't so much of an interest to me. So I just finished my engineering degree and I actually got a job with a traffic engineer and I was going to go to law school. I passed the LSAT, but you get a job, you make some money.
Yeah. You get comfortable. Yeah. You're like, okay,
so,
this is it.
So that was it.
And when you were in University of Utah, that's when you meet your husband of today and the only husband you've had, I'd imagine. And you meet in what, this engineering program?
I was 17, my calculus 111 class, big auditorium. And I sat on one side and I saw this guy who was very exotic to me in Levi's and cowboy boots and very skinny, long hair. And I just kind of really, really thought he was very, very cute. Well, we didn't talk until the end of that quarter. And then at the end, he came over and he said, would you like to come to my apartment for avocado and cheese sandwiches? And I said, no, I can't. And that was it. And then I didn't see him for like two more years. I came from an all-girls boarding school, so that wasn't done. By that time, I had gone through the sorority system. I wasn't quite as innocent. And we started studying together and we became very good friends. We hung out, but we each had serious relationships in between. And then we got together after college.
One of your first things was you were consulting for Parsons, a global engineering and construction firm. And ultimately you established their Orange County
office.
Mm-hmm. Where is Paul, your husband, in all this? Because I know he's a big deal in the field of civil engineering as well.
So Paul's degree, it's a little Freudian, was in mining engineering. But mining was very, very flat when he graduated. So he managed major construction projects. And so when we got engaged, he actually moved to Texas and I moved to Arizona, and we did this long distance thing when Southwest first opened, which was super fun until we moved in together. And then all of this, you know, romance back and forth. He moved to Phoenix and he was working on a major highway project and I was working for the city of Phoenix, but, it was really hot and Paul's a mountain boy. He wanted the mountains. And so we knew we were leaving there, and he got an offer in Northern California for a major construction company. So I just kind of was looking wherever he was going. And at the last minute, they said, well, your first project is down in Orange County. And we were not very keen on Southern California. But the very, very first place that I visited with my parents as a family vacation, and I'm going to say it was maybe in 1979, was Laguna Beach.
Wow.
And we stayed at Vacation Village, and I still have a picture of my dad on the corner. And so when Southern California was an option, I said, well, the only place I want to move to is Laguna Beach. Now, at this point, I did not have a job because my jobs were all up there, but we moved here anyway. And then I worked, I got a job with Parsons pretty quick afterwards because, you know, women engineers are in demand.
Good.
And I was pretty good.
Well, what I wanted to ask you also to share with listeners is, what exactly is the job description of a civil engineer?
Okay. So there's very, very many different disciplines in civil engineering. So there's construction engineering, construction management. So what Paul's, what he did before he started his company is he managed the construction of the freeways. So in our business, Mountain Pacific, where his expertise and what he did was very niche, he designed all the temporary structures for these freeways. So if you see any sort of permanent structure that's sitting on like some lattice of woodwork.
Yes.
That is the stuff that Paul does. And then my expertise. So even though I'm a civil engineer by degree and a PE, professional engineer, civil engineering, my expertise is in transportation. So my roles have been the planning of all of these freeways.
Okay. Let's switch to your exciting life of travel and just being in Africa so many times and on so many safaris. And tell us about how that's affected or changed your life, those experiences being amongst the wildlife and the cultures.
I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask that question because it's kind of what I grew up with. But there is a feeling when I go to Africa, I can smell it. I can smell the earth. I just feel very, very comfortable there. And it's just seeing nature. We think that we are, you know, the perfect body out there, we humans, but we're not. The animals really know. There's so much instinct there and there's so much love and I don't know. It's just magical, really.
What's your favorite animal?
An elephant.
Oh, I always say that's my spirit animal.
Really?
They're so nurturing and they're so loving.
I learned that it's true that elephants never forget.
Well, my girlfriend used to tell me, I never forget.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, so interesting. And did I hear you recently were in Africa?
Was.
And you got to visit with the gorillas, aka Gorillas in the Mist, the Diane Fossey.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if anybody's seen that or read that, but there was once a movie about this woman who lived with the gorillas and they called it Gorillas in the Mist. So tell me a little bit about that.
So Diane Fossey was a researcher, I think for Stanford, I might be wrong on that. And she convinced one of her advisors that she would go study gorillas in Africa. And she went first to the Congo, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo. And she kind of got ousted out of there, lots of threats, and she ended up in Rwanda. And at the time, she befriended a family of mountain gorillas, and there were only 200 gorillas in this little area, which was bounded by Congo, Uganda, and Rwanda. And the reason for that is that they were being poached by the locals. So she started a program to stop the poachers. Very okay. dangerous. She was a single woman living in the middle of Africa.
Did she have soldiers to protect her?
She did not, but she had trekkers. And unfortunately, she actually did get killed. They don't know who did it. Probably the poachers. It could have even been a government situation because they were selling gorillas to these zoos and outside. Anyway, as a result, though, of her work, the gorilla population has grown from 200 to 1,030 right now.
Bravo.
Which is not,
it's not enough, but it's not beautiful.
Enough in 20 years. But so gorillas are still difficult to see. You do have to climb up these mountains in mud and trek through the jungle. But when you see them, it kind of stops your heart. They're just amazing. They share 98% of our DNA.
Amazing.
So we were close enough to them that we had to wear masks. So
incredible.
We wouldn't share any viruses.
Yeah. And did you feel threatened?
You know, yes, but you kind of calm down. Like your heart stops. And they had told us you're not going to want to take photographs for the first 20 minutes. And sure enough, you don't. And then you're like, it was beautiful. Magical. Animals are amazing. And how they... The silverback in our clan had a little orphan, and males usually don't take care of the children, but he had this little orphan whose mom had died, and the orphan sat at his back and he took care of it the whole time. It was amazing. It was a bucket list experience, and it did not disappoint.
Wow. I wish I can do that. I hope that I get to do that someday. Okay. So being in Africa, switching from the wildlife to the fact that you were there during apartheid, mm-hmm. What was that like?
Well, it wasn't great. I mean, that's the reason we came to the States. It was a different cultural experience because you had the Afrikaners, you know, who were very religious. And I think that they believed that the white man was superior to the black man. I mean, that was kind of like in their religious thought. And then you had the British, who were totally the opposite. But the Afrikaners ruled while we were there. So I went to a very progressive British school. We were actually the first school in Johannesburg that accepted people of color. But, you know, ultimately, Africa is a very fascinating and a difficult place because it doesn't matter what political regime is in place. There's a lot of corruption still. There isn't really a democratic process, and it's difficult. South Africa, in my mind, I would not live in South Africa, even though it is now a free democratic country. I wouldn't live there because I think it's kind of flipped too far. There's a lot of crime, and there's still the same problems in terms of poverty and segregation that there were, because the government has now decided that they're going to, they're corrupt. They take more money for themselves instead of actually helping the population.
So. And so growing up, then, you know, living here, and How did you feel when you saw the Black Lives Movement happening? Did you feel supportive of that movement here in America, or what kind of feelings did that evoke?
Well, I'm supportive of all protests, peaceful protests. And I think it's very, very important to have free speech. So I'm 100% supportive of that. I don't know what the result has been. And I'm unfortunately reading that a lot of the Black Lives Matter leadership has taken a lot of the money that we all donated to them. So it's kind of a sad situation. I feel like there's a lot of altruistic behavior that is not happening today. You know, everything is happening for a different reason than what it's portrayed to be. So I don't know. How do you feel about the Black lives?
I think that I'm a person who believes that we are all God's children and that everybody deserves dignity and respect.
100%.
I think the movement was well-intended, and I wish that it would have some really productive results. I don't know that I can point at what those results are as of this moment. I think that there's just a great increase in many ugly things right now, in anti-Semitism and anti-gay and no trans. I mean, who goes and picks on drag queens? I mean, so, you know, it's an interesting time. But I think that ultimately we're going to get back to humanity, and there's hopefully going to be a way and a, you know, an open door for people to come in and prove their worth, not by the color of their skin, by their achievements and their accomplishments and their personal value, you know.
100%.
Which leads me to,
yeah,
where do you get your news and how do you vet your sources?
Well, I try to read as much as I can. I don't watch news very much anymore. I think they're very biased. I sometimes listen to the BBC, NPR, right. You know, on Sunday mornings, I will go through, that's kind of like when I have time, I'll do Fareed, I do Meet the Press, I'll do Media Buzz, which is Fox. But I think that guy really does a really good analysis of how the media is treating the stories, both on the right and the left. So it's very fascinating to me.
I wanted to ask you then politically too, you must not have been, being a Serbian, you must not have been much of a fan of Bill Clinton.
Well, I actually was.
Okay. So were you good with him taking out Slobodan Milosevic?
Yes, because Milosevic was a nationalist. I mean, he was a bad person. Okay. I wasn't happy about him bombing Belgrade, which is actually what happened. And I think that was not a good call. I think I don't understand. We have such good military precision. Why we're just not taking specific people out instead of doing a whole bunch of collateral damage. But I don't blame him for that.
Okay. I was wondering because I felt like being an American girl watching that go down, I thought, yay, they got rid of that guy. He was bad.
100%.
But then I met other people, American Serbians, who were like, no. And I thought, well, I don't know both sides of this. So I wanted your take on that.
My mom was always, oh, you know, we didn't do any of those atrocities. Well, yes, we did. There's proof that the Serbs did it. So it's kind of where you're getting your information.
Right.
From.
Again.
Like everything else.
Yeah, yeah. So having gotten through that, I want to ask you, what do you feel about the current political landscape in America right now?
Ooh, I feel dismayed. I have to say, my husband says no matter how bad both parties are, the economy seems to be ticking really well. But I think it's sticking really well for people who are already established. Right. I'm worried about my children, you know. And I think part of the whole situation is that we just have two political parties. I feel like we need at least one other viable party to make things start moving and also to develop some moderation in political decisions.
Is there anything, or if there is, what is it that makes you optimistic about the future of this country?
Well, my children make me optimistic because it seems like kids always seem to have a good perspective and will always kind of work it out. I'm hoping my children will have children. And I see, I think for a while, all the kids were really scared about having children because there's climate change. You know, they can't afford housing. They want to travel. They don't know about the jobs market. But I think we're at a point, like when there's a problem, America always finds a solution, and we have to find technological and social and political solutions to fix a problem. And that's how you advance. I mean, you know, technology will fix a lot of things. We, you know, everyone's scared of stuff, but when you have a problem, you find a solution somehow. And I think that's been a history of our country.
Are you excited about AI?
I am cautiously excited about AI. Again, facts in, facts out, yeah. That kind of situation. So yeah. It's a very challenging situation because you've got to make sure that whoever is developing the code is ethically wise and balanced.
Right. So we want it to be used for the benefits of society and the future progression of our world, because I'm seeing, you know, these things that go on kind of threaten our safety. And I'm such a live and let live person, but I do feel that there needs to be regulation.
I agree.
Even free speech, if it's dangerous or inspired by hate. I think it needs to be regulated.
Well, I do too. When I say free speech, it's free speech in the traditional way. No hate speech, no libel, that kind of thing. You absolutely have to have regulation.
Yes, I guess the real tricky thing is who is going to do the regulating, you know?
Exactly.
But I'm excited about the AI thing regardless.
I think cautiously excited.
Cautiously
right?
excited. I think it'll open up a whole new world of opportunity and careers. And it's just a matter of learning how to transition. And for the future, you know, for the kids.
We're at that point where you're looking at a solution to a problem and you just have to make it fit what your needs are.
I also wanted to ask you if there is one thing that you could put your finger on that concerns you most about America. What is your biggest concern? Is it environmental? Is it people's rights? Give me the one hot item that keeps you up the most.
Well, all of those things, but I think our education system, I think, is deteriorating. I feel like we are feeding people information, but we're not letting them analyze it and think for themselves. And I just feel like we're not on par with other countries in terms of education, elementary through high school education. I think our colleges are still far superior than anywhere else. You can see why everybody wants to study in America. But to get there, we're having fewer and fewer of our kids being able to cope in college. And I'm not saying every kid has to go to college. I don't believe in that at all. I think you need to follow your passion and get the kind of experience and expertise that supports what you want to do. But I feel like our kids' age is maybe the last generation for a few until they sort of figure this out, that is getting its full breadth of historical and geographical and societal information in terms of education.
Well, thank you. And we both had our kids go through the public system. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate that we're in a good place for public schools.
100%.
And I couldn't agree with you more. I think nationally, it's very important that people from all economic backgrounds should be able to be provided a fine education. I think it's what will keep us the greatest country, the greatest nation, and the greatest place to be. So thank you for that. And just tell me one more thing, and because I know your time is valuable and I'm so grateful and honored that you shared it with me today and our listeners. Tell me about what compels you to go and work at the food bank every week.
Well, I think it's a couple of things. The biggest thing is we've always given to different charities, and it's always been more monetarily because of the fact that we both full-time employed. You know, we just did not have the time. And so the thing about actually going and giving time every week is incredibly satisfying. I've met a lot of people there at the food pantry, and people are suffering. You know, people are really suffering, and it's good to provide at least a little bit of help. And if I can do it by working, and then it's a great thing to do. It's work. I consider it work. My job.
I know. I've seen the Laguna Food Pantry and the line of people, and it is work. And thank you for doing that. I think, you know, everybody should be able to get a meal, you know, so it's a beautiful thing that you're doing. And if anybody out there is interested in donating to the Laguna Food Pantry, you can go online and just Google Laguna Food Pantry, and that would be wonderful. So, all right, Tiana, I'm so happy that you were here today, and I appreciate your story, and thank you for sharing it with us, and I hope this next chapter post-retirement is a lot of fun and filled with travel, and that you get to go back and visit the gorillas. I'd love to go with you.
Thank you, Debbie. And, you know, I was listening to a couple of podcasts earlier today, and you do amazing work asking these questions because it's so important for people to understand where they're coming from and to kind of get behind their beliefs and their core values. And I think it's fascinating. So well done.
This episode of Debra Craddock was hosted by me, Debra Drucker. It was produced by Lee Rocker with co-production and editing by Gideon Brower. Our amazing music was performed by Amy Nelson and Kathy Guthrie of Folk Uke. Be sure to rate and review this episode wherever you listen to podcasts. For more Deborah Craddock, check out deborahcraddock.com and our Instagram at Deborah Craddock. That's D-E-B-O-R-A-H Craddock, like Democratic. Until next time.
Political is personal, so let's talk about it.